My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking once again to Phil Margolin. Phil, welcome back to KBOO.
Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, I don't have to welcome you to Portland because you live here.
Yeah, I'm actually about 5 minutes from the studio, so it was pretty easy to get over.
Okay, so did you take your bike or did you just walk?
I drove my car.
Oh,
I'm an old man. I'm an old man. I can't do all that.
Say no more. Okay. Phil Margolin was once a criminal defense attorney. You don't do any of that anymore, do you?
No, I stopped in 1996. I did it for about 25 years, but the book tours made it impossible for me to practice. I was doing mostly death penalty murder cases and big federal drug stuff where you're in court a couple of weeks, a couple of months. And the book tours have taken me out of Portland for sometimes up to 6 weeks to maybe 3 months.
Mm-hmm. Well, it says you have nearly a quarter of a century experience. It is a quarter century working in Portland. You've had appeals before the U.S. Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals from the Ninth Circuit, the allegedly liberal Ninth Circuit, the Oregon Supreme Court, and the Oregon Court of Appeals. You were the first Oregon attorney to use the battered women's syndrome to defend an abused woman. Good for you. Two of your books and a short story have been made into films. From 65 to 67, you're a Peace Corps volunteer in Liberia, West Africa, in Monrovia or out in the bush?
In Monrovia.
He worked his way through law school by teaching junior high school in the South Bronx, which is only slightly more dangerous than Liberia. You're the author of Supreme Justice and Executive Privilege, along with 13 other novels and short stories. All of your novels have been New York Times bestsellers. And in fact, that is the title of your latest book, Supreme Justice. Your last name is spelled Margolin, and it's published by Harper. Did I leave anything out that you want everybody to know?
Just that I'm heavily involved with a nonprofit called Chess for Success that uses chess to trick elementary school kids into learning study skills. And that's really something I'm very passionate about.
Mm-hmm. Well, anything that works, as far as I'm concerned. We can't get them to read, so. As I was reading this book, I was thinking it's about the replacement of a Supreme Court justice. A Supreme Court justice resigns because of personal problems, and there has to be a replacement justice for the court. And we're going through that now. And we will be going through it probably again because even Nino Scalia is getting old. Why did you decide? This is probably a stupid question, but answer it anyway. How did you come to the conclusion that it would be a good thing to write about a Supreme Court nomination?
Well, actually, I didn't. What happened was executive privilege raised the question, could a president of the United States be a serial killer? And that takes place in the executive branch. And at the end of the book, Brad Miller, one of the two main characters, gets a clerkship at the U.S. Supreme Court. And I had not intended to write a sequel, but the book did really well. I really liked the characters. Dana Cutler is a terrific character. She's the other main character. And
you were here talking about that with us when it came out.
And my publisher said, could you do a sequel? And I thought, well, I can't really write on demand usually. It's the hardest thing for me is getting an idea. And sometimes it takes me years to do it. But I came up with a plot very quickly that would have a issue that would get up to the could get up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So I thought, okay, Brad's there naturally, and it's the second branch of government. Why not see if I can do a sequel? I'd never written a sequel before, so a book that starts very shortly after the one before it ends. So that was the motivation, and during the course of writing the outline for the book, I always do very extensive outlines, and they take me months sometimes. I decided that the guts of this thing is that a intelligence agency is trying to cover up an illegal operation that happened years before, and there's a case, an appeal up in the U.S. Supreme Court that could re-raise it. So they are trying desperately to keep this case from ever getting to the court. And there's a process called a petition for writ of certiorari. And what happens is you don't really appeal cases to the U.S. Supreme Court. You petition for certiorari, and then they do
cert, as we call it.
Yeah, and the justices decide whether or not to grant it. And so the whole book is basically about this attempt to keep cert from being granted. One way they're doing it is trying to manipulate the nomination to make sure someone that is on the inside of this this illegal intelligence operation will get on the court. And then there's also an attempt to murder one of the justices who they believe would vote to grant cert. So all the intrigue inside the court grows out of this old case involving a ghost ship on the Columbia River.
Well, let's back up a little bit.
Okay.
This is a case about a woman named Sarah Woodruff who allegedly killed a man named John Finley, who was her lover.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, the dead John Finley shows up,
mm-hmm.
or at least a judge is convinced to his satisfaction that John Finley has, in fact, never been murdered. And then John Finley turns up dead again, and they retry Sarah Woodruff. Now, isn't there something called double jeopardy? How is this possible?
Okay, so double jeopardy works when you go through an actual trial and you're acquitted. And in this case, there's not a trial with a resolution. And that was one of the fun things. For years, I've had this idea. And like I said, it's not unusual for me to take years to develop plots. And one idea I had is about someone who's tried twice for the murder of the same person. So this fit in just perfectly. And Finley is the captain of this ship where five dead men are found.
In Shelby, Oregon.
Shelby, Oregon, which is a made-up. And I actually had an interview with someone on the radio from Shelby, Montana, and I'd forgotten that I'd call my little town Shelby. And he said, why'd you do that? And I said, oh, I didn't know you had one in Montana. But basically what happens is there's a night watchman calls up the police in a small town and says he's heard shots on board this freighter that's anchored in an out-of-the-way port near a warehouse.
The China Sea.
When they police, the two local cops come, they find five dead men on the ship, and it's loaded to the gills with hashish. But before they can investigate, Homeland Security shows up and tells them to get off the ship, turn over any evidence they have, and forget everything they've seen. They come back the next day. The ship's gone, the hashish is gone, the dead men are gone, and so is the night watchman. So Finley is the only survivor, and then he gets murdered, and his case is the one, or the case is Sarah Woodruff, who is convicted of murdering him and is on death row. That's the case that gets up to the court.
Mm-hmm. Now, it occurred to me when I was reading this that conventions of crime fiction is that the local cops are doing a terrific job and suddenly the feds come in, the FBI comes in or somebody like that. Now it's Homeland Security that even screws the FBI when the FBI is trying to do a case. Does stuff like this actually happen?
No, you know, I practiced criminal law for a long time and I just don't think, I mean, I never saw these jurisdictional battles that they have on TV shows and in movies. And quite frankly, I think sometimes the FBI likes the idea of being thought of as a bunch of bozos because I think it gives the impression that they're not very competent when my impression has always been that the DEA and the FBI and local police are pretty competent. It doesn't mean they don't screw up from time to time. We see that occasionally. Everybody is fallible. But I always had a lot of respect for the feds when I was in state in federal court and the case had been investigated by DEA or the FBI. And like I said, you're going to have bad cops, you're going to have this and that, but every profession has a small percentage that is not very good, and every profession is going to have screw ups. So, but for the most part, I don't think that happens.
Mm-hmm. As a New York City kid and an aging hipster, I never had much respect for cops.
Mm-hmm.
However, since I started writing crime fiction, I've developed more than a grudging respect for police, for local police, who have a really terrible job to do, mm-hmm. and generally do it fairly well. I mean, we have issues in this town, of course, and there's issues in every place in the country where police have to police citizens. But in general, most cops do a good job and try to be fair and not corrupt. Honest, I guess, is the right word. And this book has two cops who refuse to accept what's been handed to them and decide that they need to investigate further. One is Tom Oswald, and the other is Daphne Haggard. Can you tell us about them?
Yeah, and Tom is the local guy in Shelby who is really upset that the Homeland Security guys not only barged in and took over the investigation, which they probably would have turned over to the state police anyway, but the thing that really, really upsets him is when all the evidence disappears and everything's swept under the rug. So he is somebody who injects himself into this investigation in a way I don't want to really say because it spoils it. The other one is Daphne Haggard. She's in Inverness, Wisconsin, a fictional town. Originally, it was going to call it Balmoral, and just before we went to press, the copy editor found out that there was a Balmoral, Wisconsin. So I had to change the name to Inverness. She gave up a position on the Chicago police because her husband, who's a college professor, got a job at Inverness University. And she made the sacrifice, and she's the, open quote, homicide investigator for this tiny college town. But really, they don't have
work very hard.
Well, they don't. Most of her stuff is not homicide.
Domestic violence and stuff like that.
And then a college student finds a thigh, human thigh, in the woods outside the college. And one of the fun things I love to do in books is to have subplots that appear to have nothing whatsoever to do with the main plot, but then eventually weave together at the end to be a major part of the story. And the subplot that runs through this is her attempt to find out the identity of the person whose thigh is found out in the woods. And at the very end of the book, she does, and it's the key pretty much to the entire mystery that develops with the attempts to murder the Supreme Court justice. So that was a lot of fun for me because I had to talk to the medical examiner. Mm-hmm. Karen Gunson.
Isn't she delightful?
She's great. She helps almost every book that I write. I have a little in the acknowledgments. And thank you.
She has the most wonderfully twisted sense of humor. You know, I really love her.
And she's very inventive. The way that Daphne figures out who the thigh belongs to was what Karen invented. And I thought, well, we do DNA, but I really didn't want to do DNA because everyone does DNA. And she called me up a day or so after I presented with the problem. She said, well, Phil, I think I've got a better way for you. And she told, I don't want to disclose what it is, but she told me how you could find out who this thigh belonged to in a really cool way.
I'd like to remind our listeners, I'm speaking with Philip Margolin. Title of his latest book is Supreme Justice, published by Harper. Let's go back to the Supreme Court nomination. Mm-hmm. Now, the people involved in the plot, let's call it the plot, want to get a woman named Audrey something or other. On the court because she's pretty much part of the plot. She's in on the whole thing. And if she gets on the court, no matter what kind of a justice she would be, although one doubts that she would be a good one, she at least will not grant cert to this case.
Right.
And that's their immediate concern. So here I am thinking, especially now with Elena Kagan getting raked over the coals by idiots. There are ways to manipulate the process here that probably most Americans don't know anything about. Did you think about the larger issues that you're bringing up here about manipulation of a process of something as important as the Supreme Court, which is the third branch of government? The Constitution says we need to have it.
Well, I don't think what happens in the book could not happen. Could happen theoretically in real life, but I this is fiction. In real life, these nominating things have turned into just a three-ring circus, and it's very disappointing to me. I argued in the U.S. Supreme Court about a quarter of my practice.
Whose court? Who was the Chief Justice?
It was Berger at the time.
Wow,
so it was 1970. I was a kid. I was 34 years old. I'd been in practice about 5 years and get up. And for those listening to you who don't know, arguing at the Supreme Court for a lawyer is like playing the Super Bowl if you're a football player. Hardly anyone ever gets to get up there. I think they take about 4% of the cases that are where there's a petition for cert. So I was really nervous, and I'm usually very relaxed in court. I mean, I'm just very at ease, and I wasn't when I made the argument. But the problem that I see is that what everybody should be looking for is the finest legal mind in the country and a person who can set aside their personal beliefs and views and be open-minded, because what you're doing as a judge is you're trying to decide, given an established law and a set of facts, whether what happened was an error at a trial, whether the judge at the trial made a mistake. That's the whole thing that an appellate court does. They're like instant replay in football. They take a look at what happened at the trial, and there's a transcript word for word of whatever happened, and they try to decide, did the judge mess up or not? And then if he did mess up, could it have affected the verdict? And if they decide those two things, that there was an error and that it could affect, they have to send the case back for a new trial. And judges, really should, and I don't like activist judges or guys with ideologies on either the left or the right. I don't think that's the proper way to judge. You shouldn't have an ideology and then try to stuff everything into that. You should be very open-minded and just try to use your brain and come to the right conclusion. So these litmus test stuff and, how are you going to vote on abortion and all this stuff, it should never come up. And
well, that genie is out of the bottle. There's no way we're going to stuff that baby back in.
Well, and it's really interesting because what happened was just fortuitously for me, because it got me on a lot of radio shows and TV shows I wouldn't have otherwise, but Obama made this nomination right when my book came out. So I've been asked a lot of questions about this. Could Elena Kagan be a judge when she has never been a judge? And that's a stupid question, because anyone who knows, anyone who graduated from law school, quite frankly, could sit on the Supreme Court. They couldn't try a shoplifting case at a trial level. But all you learn in law school is how to look at legal issues from two different points of view. The justices on the Supreme Court get very lengthy briefs from both sides, outlining the exact legal problem. They have really brilliant clerks who then do a lot of research for them. They themselves should be really smart, and they all are. Even if you disagree with their philosophies, you usually have to concede that the guy's a pretty smart person. And so it's not that tough a job, theoretically. I mean, you have to make very important decisions. So the fact that Kagan has no judicial experience is ridiculous. She's a solicitor general of the U.S. She clerked for a Supreme Court justice and a court of appeals judge, and she's a solicitor general. So they make these things into circuses, and there's a trying to jimmy the court to make it political. But quite frankly, that's been going on forever. And before I went on any radio shows where I knew I'd be asked about this, I took a look at a biography of Brandeis, who was back in the 1930s, and I was under the impression that at that point they were just looking for the best legal mind, but I hadn't read the biography in ages. It was the same stuff as going on today: political assassination. The business didn't want them on, so it's been going on forever and ever and ever. It's not a new thing. It's just sad that we don't pick our justices in a more objective way.
I don't want to start a whole new tangent on this, but how hard a job can it be if Clarence Thomas could do it? So
Clarence Thomas is not a dummy. He shouldn't be on there because he really hadn't done much. It's not to say he's not a dummy. He went to Yale Law School, and the guy's obviously very smart. Well, I'll tell you, quite frankly, one of the things that really impressed me was how smart these guys are. When I went up and argued, I was under the impression that all the conservative guys on the court were morons. But then when I went up and actually had to argue in front of them and got the questions from them, I realized that they're pretty smart cookies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. We tend to equate people who don't agree with us with not being very bright, but that's not necessarily true. Not necessarily. Two things. a little minor subplot here, which turns out to be a major part of the process, is the role of the tabloid press. Now, the tabloid press has never really had much of a reputation in this country. I'm old enough to remember Confidential Magazine, which was the vilest character assassination tool you could possibly imagine, faking stories. I mean, it's not like the Inquirer faking stories about aliens coming down and stealing Elvis's love child or anything like that. We're talking about real vicious things said about people because they thought they could get away with it because people didn't want to keep suing them every 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And they would go to court with every suit and they would lose and they would keep doing it anyway. So, but lately, the last 5 years or so, for some reason, the tabloid press has been right about things before the mainstream press even, they stole the march, I guess, is the cliche about it. You know, they were out and doing it when the tabloid, when the mainstream press was still in bed sleeping. And that happens here. Yeah, tell us a little bit about this this tabloid publisher, and I kind of like him.
Well, Exposed is actually I introduced the supermarket tabloid Exposed in Lost Lake, and Patrick Gorman is this guy that runs this thing, and it makes its money off of UFO and Bigfoot and Elvis sightings, but every once in a while, like it gets involved in one of these big political cases, and the heroine Dana Cutler breaks the story about whether or not the president of the U.S. is a serial killer in Exposed when she's sort of forced to go there, and then I bring Gorman and Exposed back in Supreme Justice because I just love the idea of this little tabloid crazy nutty newspaper beating all the New York Times, and they actually get the Pulitzer Prize after they break the Farrington story in executive privilege. So that it's just a fun thing. I thought it'd be sort of, you know, I just did it again, not intending to ever bring this character back when I did had Gorman and Exposed in
executive privilege.
Lost Lake. Lost Lake was an older book where the heroine works for the paper. She is the daughter of a army general and was in a mental hospital and has no credibility. And the only job she could ever get is working for this crazy paper. So I love the paper and I like the idea. So I've brought them back in both executive privilege and Supreme Justice. And, you know, Gorman, because he doesn't care, he can get these crazy stories out before the regular newspapers like the Post do. And he says one of the only thing he really liked about getting the Pulitzer was being able to watch the green tint on the expressions of all the people from all the hoity-toity papers.
Yeah, well, ask John Edwards what he thinks about the tabloid press and their efficacy. One more thing, covering up a crime with worse crimes. Now, this is, alas, too true in the real world that as the Nixon taught us, and nobody seems to have learned since, the only thing that's worse than the crime is the cover-up. If you own up right away, things may not be as bad for you as if you try to keep covering it up. Yes, no, you're making a skeptical face.
Well, I think it depends on what the crime is. In Supreme Justice, you know, it would be confessing that you're smuggling a whole, you know, hold full of hashish into the country, which is a major super felony. So it depends on what the crime. I do agree that in most cases, if the crime's a minor crime or indiscretion like Tiger Woods or you're fooling around with somebody, it's much better to just come clean right off the bat. I think it was Andy Pettit with the steroids. Everybody else said, I never used them and made a big thing out of it. He said, yeah, I used it a couple of times and I shouldn't have done it. And nobody's mentioned Andy Pettit forever. Mm-hmm. But Barry Bonds and Sammy Sosa and all these other guys have been in the headlines and everyone mentions them. No one mentions Pettit. So I do agree. Usually it's better to just come clean. But again, it depends on how serious a crime is. So if it was a quadruple murder and you get in and say, yeah, I killed all four guys, but hell, I apologize. And I really learned a lesson from that. I don't think that's a good strategy.
Give me about a minute on this because we're running close to time. A lot of this is set in Washington, D.C., naturally, mm-hmm. because it's the Supreme Court. excuse me. How much time do you spend in D.C.? You seem to know the area pretty well.
Well, I went to undergraduate at American. As I said, I not only argued the U.S. Supreme Court, but I visited it a couple of times. My daughter got a master's degree there and was a presidential fellow. The most fun for doing Supreme Justice was I got a two-hour tour by Bill Souter as the clerk of the court. And that was just fabulous because I was too nervous to ask for a tour, you know, when I did my argument. But the thing I learned that was the most interesting is, do you know what the highest court in the land is?
Okay. Ninth Circuit?
No, it's the regulation-sized basketball court on the roof of the U.S. Supreme Court, which is physically above the courtroom, and everyone at the court calls it the highest court in the land. And these clerks and the justices are there 12 to 16 hours a day, and they have barbershops in the court and everything that normal humans would do outside of the court, like cut their hair and stuff. These guys need to have some access. So they have a full gym, and I got to see the gorgeous library. So that, for me, was the biggest payoff for writing this book, was I got to this fabulous tour of the court, got to see where the clerks come into the court, and the hair went up on the back of my head when I got back in that courtroom and saw the podium that I'd argued at. It was, for me, it was a very emotional moment.
Yeah, there are the machinery of government, which we fetch about constantly, is actually very impressive when you're faced with it. It's there's tradition and there's a dignity there that maybe sometimes it doesn't even deserve. But
I lived in a dictatorship in Liberia for 2 years and really made me appreciate our system of government. It is far from perfect. There are huge flaws in it, but considering how powerful a country we have and how well our citizens are treated, even though sometimes it doesn't seem that we treat them well, it's a pretty amazing form of government democracy. And like I say, with all the flaws, I still prefer it to other types of government. Mm-hmm. So,
what are you working on now?
Sequel to Supreme Justice. It's, you know, poor Brad, it's a one-year clerkship, and we got a recession. I had to get him a job, and I've done the executive branch. I've done the judicial branch, and now I'm going to have him working at the U.S. Senate. So
by a process of elimination. I mean, what's after that? The Department of Agriculture?
Got the FCC, Social Security.
Social Security, have him work there.
IRS.
Maybe you can fix that mess. Yeah. It's been always fun to talk to you. Philip Margolin, Margolin. Title of the book is Supreme Justice, published by Harper. Come back when Brad is working for his Senatron in Washington.
Anytime. Okay. Anytime.